Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com.
Today in Studio 360, we are all about family values. The indie rock star Tao sings the praises of her mom.
She's seriously the most amazing woman and the strongest and most durable human being I've ever met.
The young director Ben Zeitlin gives his parents some credit for his Oscar-nominated movie Beasts of the Southern Wild.
My parents are both folklorists. There's importance to the cultures of the world, and to see them disappear is the worst kind of death. I think that that was instilled in me by the folks.
And I'll talk with the current number one hit musician, Macklemore, whose gay marriage anthem came from close to home.
I also come from the Catholic Church and the hip-hop community. And I have two gay uncles and a gay godfather and was raised around gay men. So I have kind of these polar opposite upbringings. And I kind of merged those all together and put it into a record.
That's all ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to five individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Hey, Macklemore, can we go thrift shopping?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The number one hit right now on the Billboard charts is an unlikely one for two reasons. First, the record came out with no label. It was released by the Seattle rapper who calls himself Macklemore. And second, it's a song about being thrifty.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm looking for a come up.
Being a white guy in rap takes a certain amount of chutzpah. Being a white guy rapping about buying tatty secondhand clothes, that is a whole other level.
Damn, that's a cold-ass honky.
I spoke with Macklemore a few months ago after he'd just come to national attention with a song called Same Love. It was an anthem on behalf of Washington State's same-sex marriage initiative, which voters approved in November.
For those that like the same sex, have the characteristics. The right-wing conservatives think it's a decision. And you can be cured with some treatment and religion. Man-made rewiring of a predisposition, playing God. Oh, nah, here we go. America the brave still fears what we don't know. And God loves all his children.
I asked him if he thought the YouTube sensation of his song Same Love had affected the vote.
Yes, I do. To put an issue like same-sex marriage out there and to have a video that really gave a visual narration to it that connected with people on a personal, emotional level, I think that it did have
some... Make some people vote.
It made some people vote. You know, I don't want to take too much credit.
No, but the fact that you said yes makes me as if I already wasn't predisposed to like you rather than saying, well, no. Good for you.
Thank you.
For owning a little bit of it.
We were aware of it. We knew it was going to be a tight race.
Yeah.
And it was an important issue for me personally. And to watch the people's reaction, people whose lives were affected by the song, personal testimonies and emails that we were getting, I would be almost too humble to downplay
right.
some of the power in the record.
Rappers have, for the last 30 years, not been known for endorsing gayness in their lyrics,
no.
shall we say.
I don't know ever.
Right. So at what point did you decide, I need to do this?
I watched so many records receive critical acclaim that were very derogatory to homosexuals. That and misogyny are still kind of the two very acceptable means of oppression in terms of hip-hop culture. And it's 2012. There needs to be some accountability. I think that as a society, we are evolving, and I think that hip-hop has always been a representation of what's going on in the world right now. My mother sent me a newspaper article. A 13-year-old kid killed himself over being called faggot in school. And that was kind of it for me. I realized it was an epidemic. I realized that this needs to be addressed. I started writing it from the perspective of this gay bullied kid. I played it for my producer, Ryan Lewis, and he immediately was like, you know what, this is good, but this isn't your story, and you have a story. And my story is I'm from Seattle, Washington, a very liberal part of the city, Capitol Hill, and I also come from the Catholic Church and the hip-hop community, which stereotypically are very homophobic communities. So, and I have two gay uncles and a gay godfather and was raised around gay men. So I have kind of these polar opposite upbringings, and I kind of merge those all together and put it into a record.
There is no difference. Live on and be yourself. When I was at church, they taught me something else. If you preach hate at the service, those words aren't anointed. That holy water that you soak in has been poisoned. When everyone else is more comfortable remaining voiceless rather than fighting for humans that have had their rights stolen. I might not be the same, but that's not important. No freedom till we're equal. Damn right I support it.
Did you get any or much backlash, surprised reaction?
The surprising reaction was that there wasn't much backlash. If you read YouTube comments, you can see hateful comments all day long on any one of our videos, but particularly this one. But in terms of the hip-hop community, which I was immediately the most concerned about, how are my peers going to react to this? How are the people that I maybe want to collaborate with one day or hope to collaborate with? Am I going to be exiled? And, you know, you put it on a scale. And I think that the minute that you're scared, the minute that you're afraid is the minute that you're standing up for the right issue.
Yeah. Another one of your songs, which is very different and huge fun, this is Thrift Shop.
I'ma take your grandpa style. I'ma take your grandpa style. No, for real. Ask your grandpa, can I have his hand-me-down?
Thank you.
Velour jumpsuit and some house slippers. Dookie brown leather jacket that I found. Dig it. They had a broken keyboard. I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket. Then I bought a kneeboard. Hello, hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game. Hell no. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads will be like,
ah, he got the Velcro.
Whoa. I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is awesome.
Ow.
I'm gonna pop some tags.
It's a delightful song. You know, in rap lyrics especially, we're used to hearing kind of rags to riches stories. This is rags to cool rags.
Some more rags, yeah.
Yeah. Were you surprised that this song in particular caught on so big?
You know what? I am. I was and I still am. I mean, they're playing it on pop radio stations all over the country now. I didn't expect to have any sort of success with radio, much less Thrift Shop. I knew that it was catchy. I knew that the subject matter was fun. I thought it was going to be a very niche demographic, and that niche demographic has turned into kind of a more pop culture demographic.
And there's an interesting idea embedded in it, an idea I've written about a lot, which is that old things are perpetually these days being recycled into new, cool things, right?
Absolutely.
It's not just the thrift shop. It's a
absolutely
bigger idea.
Yeah, and like you said, it's so different than what we normally hear about. I mean, we're in hip-hop culture constantly being told to buy Louis Vuitton and buy Prada and buy this Lamborghini and buy this mansion, and it really stuck out.
The first song on this album is called 10,000 Hours, which is a reference to our friend Malcolm Gladwell's idea that it takes 10,000 hours to practice something to achieve mastery. Do you feel like that was true in your case as a rapper?
It's taken me a long time. This wasn't something that I picked up and 6 months later I was good at. It took me many, many, many years. I don't know how close I am to 10,000. I got to be close. I got to be somewhere close to it. But yeah, I think that it comes down to dedication. And I really had that at an early age. This is the only thing that I did. I kind of gave up sports. I gave up really a social life to work on music.
And when you were, let's say, at hour 400 or 500, were you aware that, like, I'm not good enough yet?
I had a mom that was really good at lying to me. So she would, anything that I did was, oh my God, that's so amazing. Yeah. And I had no idea how horrible I was. And I was horrible.
And were there points along the way, you were not an overnight success, where you felt like chucking it and trying to, you know, get your teaching credentials?
Yeah, I was close. More so than anything, it came down to drugs and alcohol. And that was my real barrier in terms of being successful. I always had this faith that if I can get sober for long enough, I can make an album. And with that album, I will be able to live off of this album.
I want to play a little bit of your song, Awake, which is two words, awake.
Am I subconscious telling me stop it? This is an issue that you shouldn't get involved in. Don't even tweet RIP Trayvon Martin. Don't want to be that white dude, Million Man Marching. Fighting for a freedom that my people stole. Don't want to make all my white fans uncomfortable. But you don't even have a fucking song for radio. Why you out here talking race, trying to save the fucking globe? Don't get involved if the cause isn't mine. White privilege, white guilt at the same damn time. So we just party like it's 1999. Celebrate the ignorance while these kids keep dying.
So that's tough. Does that make your white fans uncomfortable?
Race is a tricky issue. And it's something that I have really tried to delve into, acknowledging my white privilege, acknowledging where, you know, a large portion of my fan base comes from, and trying to break it down. It's holding myself accountable in terms of the music that I'm making now, because I know how to make a pop song. I know how to make a song that's going to make people dance. I know how to write lyrics that don't challenge the listener or myself at all. Those songs can be really fun to write, but there's bigger issues at hand, and I want to delve into those. Those are more important in terms of cultural moments, defining like what this means to be alive in 2012 and taking an analytical approach. That's who I want to be.
Ben Haggerty, it was a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ben Haggerty raps as Macklemore. I spoke with him last fall. His song Thrift Shop is now number one on the pop sales charts. And if you haven't seen the video, you can at studio360.org. Macklemore is touring the country with his producer and fellow performer, Ryan Lewis.
Return to the Mac. Get up, what it is, what it does, what it is, what it isn't. Looking for a better way to get up out of bed instead of getting on the internet and checking a new hit. Get up. Thrift Shop, hip strut walking. A little bit of humble, a little bit of cautious. Somewhere between like Rocky and Gosh.
And the Oscar goes to...
The Academy Awards are this Sunday night. We'll be watching, as always, but we wanted to make the experience a little more interactive. So we've created a social media game, Awards Night Bingo. You get a card, like in regular bingo, but instead of tiles that have B7 or N23, our tiles say things like trips on stage and thanks, lawyer. Play along with us at home. Your interactive online bingo card is waiting for you right now at studio360.org. And Sunday evening, tune into the Oscars and join our conversation on Twitter with the hashtag AwardsBingo. Still ahead right now in Studio 360, we visit the laundromat where indie rocker Tao Nguyen got her start.
I think she paid me $20 a day.
That's it. Very cheap labor.
Very cheap labor. That's right.
It's hard to yell sweatshop when mom's the boss. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The new album by the indie rocker Tao Nguyen just came out, her third with the band The Get Down, Stay Down. The record is called We the Common, and it includes a duet with the singer Joanna Newsom. Tao lives in the Pacific Northwest, but she grew up around Washington, D.C. in Arlington, Virginia, where her mother owned a coin laundromat and dry cleaning business.
Laundry and dry clean.
A few years ago, Jesse Dukes went there to meet up with Tao Nguyen and her mom.
Did you have any traffic at all?
Yes.
Oh, terrible. I just told my dad.
The laundromat is in a mini mall, one of several mini malls in the area, and it looks like, you know, a laundromat. A long, narrow room lined with washers and dryers. Tao and her mother Nan offer me green tea with ginger, and we chat a little.
I worked here the most when I was
15 years old.
12, 13, yeah. And all through high school. And when, even when I was hanging out, if there was a big load, my mom would call me.
What would you say?
I said, okay, stop by, help me. I have a lot to do, something like that.
I think she paid me $20 a day.
That's it. Very cheap labor.
Very cheap labor, that's right.
At the same time she was helping out her mom, Tao was already writing songs. And when she was a teenager, she started playing music at open mic nights, usually at bars or coffee shops and other mini malls.
And my mom actually was really lenient about curfews and stuff, because we'd have to stay pretty late. But it's hard to walk into an open mic night as a female with an acoustic guitar. You're immediately dismissed. You're a joke. It's over. The best way was to just start playing guitar and do it in a way that commanded something besides dismissal, you know?
As it turns out, Tao's acoustic guitar playing is exquisite. She doesn't do a lot of simple chord strumming. Instead, she fingerpicks complicated melodies while keeping a real rock and roll drive behind the songs. She spent hours teaching herself to play, usually while she was working at the laundromat.
So if I came here to do my laundry, I'd go and get changed, and you'd be playing guitar, and you'd have to stop.
Yeah, right. And then you would probably apologize and say sorry, and then I'd be like, this is my job, it's okay. I would get paid $20 a day to do this. And then if you know, no one was at the counter, then I'd sit out here, and then I'd try to play softly.
Tao's mother sunk her savings into buying the laundromat in 1997, after Tao's father left the family. She'd never run a business before, and apparently she figured it out pretty quickly.
After your separation or divorce, did things get tougher to support the family?
Oh, yeah, the first year.
But you've been working 7 days
seven
a week?
7 days a week,
ever
yeah.
since then?
I don't need to rest. Just after finish everything, that's a happy day for me.
After she finishes everything at the laundromat, that's a happy day.
Talk soft so you fall asleep. Cook your dinner, but you would not eat. Your sharp mouth forgets when you swore, goddamn, you wouldn't do it again. And I...
Tao wrote Feet Asleep for the new album as a tribute to her mom.
I mean, she's seriously the most amazing woman and the strongest and most durable human being I've ever met. And I watched The Laundromat when she was away, and I did maybe a third of what she normally does for 3 days, and I was exhausted, just exhausted.
Patch you up, but all these years, my feet asleep, move them around that they might breathe.
Tao's mother loves the song, and really, she loves all of Tao's songs. She sells her CDs at the laundromat and will even make unsuspecting customers call Tao so they can tell her how much they like her music. And she's always telling Tao to be more showy on stage. You know, dress up, wear makeup, move around more.
And actually, my mom made me a shirt. Right, Mom?
Yeah, with the design. The words said rock and roll.
Wait. You made a shirt that says rock and roll
fabric.
Skulls and Boats?
I think she has the material because she made it out here.
Okay.
See the school scare people.
Well, okay, so then
what was the cut, Mom?
The sexy cut, just like this. From here, no arm here.
Oh, no arm.
See?
Tao has a rehearsal later in the afternoon, and on the way, we stop at her mom's house, a red brick ranch on a quiet street in Arlington. Tao's grandma lives there too, and as soon as she sees me, she offers me some rice and tofu.
Thank you.
And eventually, we get to talking about music.
There are things that I say in my songs that I would never say in real life, you know, and only when pressed would acknowledge. Like Beat, for instance, it's a very lyrically dark song.
Tao says a lot of the new album, We Brave, Bee Stings and All, is about making sense of her father leaving and how that's affected her.
It wasn't until the end of college where I started to kind of relive it. Not just the trauma of him leaving, but also how we were similar. That I can pretty much walk away from a relationship or a friendship with no qualms. Like, I can justify letting it just kind of dissipate from my life.
Can you feel like you have that in common with your father?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's the reason I can do that, you know?
When she's not on tour with the band, the Get Down, Stay Down, Tao stays rent-free at her mom's house in Arlington. The three other guys in the band all live and work in Virginia. She's also lived in San Francisco, which some might find more exciting than Northern Virginia.
I find that it's such a stimulating place to be. And after a night of drinking or merrymaking, I'll come home and be like, well, I should have just stayed in and did the thing that I love, you know.
You don't love drinking and merrymaking?
I mean, sometimes too much. But often not enough to be doing it. And that's why the suburbs were such a productive time for me, because I was unhappy and there was nowhere I wanted to be anyway. You know, you leave the house just to be outside your house, but you're looking at other houses that look like your house. So in a way, I think it's better to come from a place that's not as vibrant or alive, because you have to infuse your life with something rather than just absorbing it from the outside.
At the age of 23, Tao's already found a way to make a living doing what she loves, and she could pretty much do it anywhere. So it's impressive that she has such a strong appreciation of family and home. And it reminds me of something her mother said back at the Met.
Sometimes I think her idea older than her eyes, you know.
Wait, say that again, I'm sorry.
She said, sometimes she thinks my ideas are older than my age. That's a good line, Mom.
Was it good?
For Studio 360, I'm Jesse Dukes.
The catch is, you stay and see what becomes of us.
Tao Nguyen, in a story we first aired in 2008. Her mother recently sold the laundromat and retired. Right now, Tao Nguyen is playing around the country with her band, and you can hear a track from the new record at studio360.org. Tao's got a way of writing songs about heavy subjects with an upbeat sensibility. It turns out she's bucking a trend there. Some researchers recently found that since 1965, around the time Good Vibrations was being dreamed up, the mood of pop songs on the Billboard chart has gotten sadder, less and less poppy. How come? We asked Ike Srikandaraja to try to find out.
Glenn Schellenberg, a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, studies music.
Basically, I think about music, listen to music, and write about music.
Professor Schellenberg thought that over the years, pop music had started sounding sadder.
I do experiments on music. I'm an experimental psychologist.
So he designed an experiment that took the top 40 songs from select years between 1965 and 2009, about 1,000 in all, and handed the playlist over to two women with good ears.
Two German women. They were both graduate students. They were in separate rooms. They worked totally independently. And the two raters were completely blind about what the hypotheses were. And all they knew is that they had to listen to all these popular songs, you know, and they got paid for it.
Paid to diagnose the mode and tempo of half a century of hits, starting with the number one song in 1965.
One, two, three, cuatro.
That year, every single was in a major mode. For the rest of the 60s, 85% of hit songs were major, and the average tempo was 116 beats per minute. But through the decades, the hits kept getting less major and less fast. By the 2000s, only 43% of top Billboard songs were in a major mode. And the BPM had fallen to 100.
So that was quite a surprise, and particularly how strong it was in terms of the shift from major key to minor key over time.
Why was music so much more fun in the 60s and 50s than it is now?
That's Alice Cooper, the Prince of Darkness Alice Cooper.
We're not worthy! We're not worthy!
Heavy metal icon and now radio host.
Oh my liberated parents, they're going out tonight.
The Beatles wrote 3-minute happy songs, and so did the Beach Boys, and so did the Four Seasons, and you turn on the radio, and that song was an upper. It wasn't a downer.
But Glenn Schellenberg and his colleagues found that pop music isn't just getting sadder. They found that the mood gets more mixed. For instance, now most dance songs are minor key, but fast.
Yo, I got that hit to beat the block. You can get that bass on below. I got that rock and roll, that future flow.
Music has made these kind of shifts before. I talked to Susanna Clark, a professor of music at Harvard. She explained how in the 17th century, Baroque music was very simple, emotionally. The happy songs were happy, the rage songs were raging. One emotion at a time.
If you listen to Salieri, who's a famous 18th century opera composer, Salieri was kind of part of the old school, where there's this unity notion.
That is, until a young upstart mixed things up.
Mozart twists and turns with the emotional expression of characters, which is sort of what he's famous for.
So Salieri, in this comparison, would be Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs with Woolly Bully in 1965, and Mozart would be...
Well, that's a dangerous one, but I would put something like... I mean, this might seem a bit shameful, but something like, say, Barbie Girl.
Hiya, Bobby.
Hi, Ken.
A big hit back in 97.
Sure, Ken.
Jump in.
I'm a Barbie girl in the Barbie world.
You know, comparing it to Mozart seems completely outrageous, right? But the fact of the matter is that that song created an effect.
Is Susanna Clark asking you to take Barbie Girl seriously?
It's a fast tempo, and it's in a minor mode.
Yes, she is.
Whereas if you wanted this to be emotional and the trauma of being a Barbie girl, then you still might have it in a minor mode, but...
You step down the tempo.
Exactly. than she said. She's a Barbie, right? if she was truly happy, she might do it in a major mode. But that doesn't work as well. Like, that's just not the same.
Superficially, it seems sort of fun. If you think about the lyrics to Barbie Girl, it's sort of a sad song. It's a dark song. It's to the writer of that music, it was a kind of irony or a kind of satire.
Chuck Klosterman writes books about pop music, and he's the ethicist for the New York Times. Chuck's here to answer the hard question. Why? Why did pop music get sadder? He says two reasons. First, a trend in all media, from video games to TV, towards realism.
And you look at those idioms over the past 50 years. In general, they have become more, for lack of a better term, realistic. And people associate realism in art with darkness.
Donkey Kong to Street Fighter to Call of Duty, or The Dick Van Dyke Show to Seinfeld to Louis.
The other part of it has to do with sort of the evolution of how seriously pop music is taken. And that pop music is taken more seriously now than it's ever been in the past.
Way too seriously, thinks Alice Cooper.
It's exactly that. All of a sudden, bands that want to sound like they're deep and serious cannot play in major keys. They want to go to minor keys to make them sound more mysterious. I've been making records since 1965 till now. I think that people think that writing in major right now is old-fashioned pop.
And who in pop music wants to be old-fashioned?
I think that we've really gotten away from the fun of rock music, and we've gotten too emotional about it.
Have we gotten too emotional about our music? Or are we just more emotional? It's that eternal question, asked here in High Fidelity.
What came first, the music or the misery? Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
In general, is society less buoyant and more confused? I guess I would say yes. But I don't really have a reason for that. I just feel that.
A tornado flew around my room before you came.
Sure we do. And so do our hits. For Studio 360... I'm Ike Sriskandaraja.
Want to see how hip-hop songs have gotten darker since 1965? We've got a cool graphic depiction at studio360.org, along with a list of all the songs used in that study. Still ahead this hour.
The whole universe depends on everything fitting together just right.
I talk with first-time director Ben Zeitlin. His movie, Beasts of the Southern Wild, is nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from Lumosity. You work out your body, but you might be ignoring your most important muscle, your brain. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Learn more about achieving a brighter brain at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The movie Beasts of the Southern Wild is a contemporary Louisiana fairy tale with a 6-year-old girl as its hero. Her name is Hush Puppy, and she lives with her father in this isolated bayou netherworld that they call the bathtub.
One day, the storm's gonna blow, the ground's gonna sink, and the
water's gonna rise up so high, there ain't gonna be no bathtub. Just a whole bunch of water.
Beasts of the Southern Wild has won all kinds of awards and is now up for Best Picture at the Oscars this weekend, and a Best Director nomination for Ben Zeitlin. He was in his 20s when he made it. It's his first feature film, and I spoke with him about it when it came out last year.
You know, I always think of it not as a fantasy movie, but a film with kind of a heightened reality that sort of happens through the subjectivity of the main character. You know, the fact that you see everything and experience everything the way that a six-year-old would, you know, at that age, you really don't parse out the difference between what's imaginary and what's actually happening. It's all very real, you know, even though adults are telling you some things are real and they aren't, you know. As a kid, you don't have that experience.
And that kid in your movie is played by Quvenzhané Wallace. She is, as you know, just exceptional and not just a cute kid who reads her lines well. She has this amazing range, and she's physically impressive as she sort of climbs over and under debris wearing the very white rubber boots I wore when I was her age. The success of this film really depends on her. How did you find her? How did you direct her?
We found her through kind of brute force. We spent 9 months looking for kids. We looked at over – we think we looked at somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 people for the role.
Down there?
All down in South Louisiana. Everybody – no one in the film had ever acted before. It was all cast locally. You know, but it wasn't like a close race. She came in and just had this – you know, you put the camera on her and you just see gears turning behind her eyes, and you see this focus and kind of morality, and just, you know, you see that and you just see your character emerge, and just you it all becomes clear when we found her.
So really, yeah. It was like an aha moment. We've got her. Stop the presses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How she's never acted before in her life. How do you direct a kid? And you've never made a feature film. How what was the process of making her do what you needed her to do?
I mean, it wasn't that tricky. It was she really has an amazing ability to internalize information, and you know, I would explain to her, you want to get your father's attention in the scene, do everything you can to get his attention. If he tries to tell you to go away, don't listen to him. And she is amazing, cuz she'll, while you're telling her this, she'll be like eating gummy bears and pulling someone's hair, and then you say, were you paying attention? He said, yeah, you want me to follow my father, blah blah blah, like, and I'll say these three lines, and she's just incredibly smart. And we initially thought that we were going to do things like have someone jump out from behind a wall and surprise her to try to get her to look surprised. But her focus is so intense that that stuff didn't work. You know, you would have someone jump out from behind the wall and she wouldn't flinch. She just would stay in character. And so we realized very quickly that we just had to work with her like an adult.
She sounds almost as extraordinary as the character.
She truly is. She truly is.
This is a story, among other things, about holdouts, people who refuse to leave their homes even when the houses have been destroyed and the sort of twisted nature is killing them. Is that a kind of character that you're drawn to in general?
Yeah, I mean, it was that was really where the film started, and it came a lot from, you know, the short film that I made in 2006, and that cast was all local, and it was all people that were there very soon after the storm. And you know, there was a lot of rhetoric in the country at that time of this sort of, why rebuild, like New Orleans just should go away, this is irresponsible to live there, and all this stuff. And I thought it was such a ridiculous conversation being there and sort of knowing these people and how much their home meant to them and how much their culture meant to them, and just the idea that it could be transplanted is just crazy. And I definitely wanted to make a film that celebrated the people that hold on and that are fighting to keep this place alive.
Does that have any analog in your life? I mean, your life on its surface seems very different than theirs.
Well, I think I come by it honestly. Like my dad tried to get down to Coney Island and handcuff himself to the Thunderbolt before they knocked it over. So, you know, this sort of notion of, my parents are both folklorists, and this notion that a place is worth preserving and a culture is worth preserving, even if it isn't designed by some famous architect, even if it doesn't have some sort of high art
or industrial
importance. It's like there's importance to the cultures of the world, and to see them disappear is the worst kind of death. And so I think that probably that was instilled in me in some visceral way by the folks.
You're from suburban New York. After Katrina, a lot of people from elsewhere came there suddenly. with ideas about how to tell the story of the people there and the land and the water and all that. Did you encounter any resistance as a carpetbagger?
No, not really. I mean, you know, among the great things about the culture is it's people are like virtuosos in making fun of someone. And so when you come down as a kid from suburban New York, you are absolute goals for ribbing and jives. And so I would hang out in the docks and just became like everybody's favorite joke. And then, you know, as you hang out longer, you tell people you're making a movie, and it's such a – the culture has such a warmth and hospitality to it that even though there's maybe a kind of wariness and a sort of territoriality when you first set foot, you know, you're around for a week and you're over for dinner and you're getting taken alligator hunting, and, you know, it really – I think I was a bit of a novelty, and that probably worked in my favor.
And so you put up with the hazing, and after a while they say, okay, fine.
Yeah, you know, they knew you would be around, and so it's like a new friend.
And the actor who plays her father, Wink, mm-hmm. he runs a local bakery?
Yeah. He ran the bakery that was across the street from our casting office, and so we just would go over there every day, get donuts, and eat lunch over there as we were doing the casting. And one day he came in for a reading, and we realized that he had it in him to play this role.
But didn't he have to run his bakery? What did you do?
Yeah, no, it was he actually, when we first gave him the role, he turned us down, and he turned us down three times because he couldn't get away from the bakery. And, you know, we promised him that basically that we would do all of our work during baker's hours. And so all the script work we did, all the interviews we did, all the line learning started at 11 o'clock at night and went till 6 in the morning while he was rolling dough and making donuts. And we sort of became part of the bakery team to keep that place alive and thriving while the film was being made.
You also composed the music in the film with Dan Romer. I want to play one of the themes, which is from the beginning of the film, before the storm, when the people in the bathtub town are having a celebration. And if you would, just if you can sort of deconstruct it as we listen and explain what we're hearing and what was the goal of the music.
Okay. Okay, yes. If we wanted to create both a feeling of like this celebration, but also let you know that something ominous is overhead, that this beautiful place is not going to stay utopian forever. What you're hearing right now is sort of Cajun song taken from the region where the film was shot by the Balfour Brothers, and we wanted to sort of mix in Cajun songs with our orchestration and kind of create something that was a blend of the two.
But me and my daddy, we stay right here. We's who the earth is for.
And then this is really the bathtub theme, and we wanted to create something that felt anthemic and like a national anthem or like Auld Lang Syne, this sort of iconic folk anthem that everyone in the town would know how to sing. Later in the film, when the place falls apart, you can sort of remember it by that song, the way that, you know, you would remember your country if it was gone by a tune that came from it.
Anthemic, which is a word thrown around a lot, is exactly right for that song, and it's one of those things that make it not like a little indie movie.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't see – we tried to score it from her point of view, and she certainly doesn't see herself as a little indie character. She's like a folk hero, or she's like a tiny little warrior, and so
– and she knows she's important for history.
Exactly.
Ben Zeitlin, congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
I spoke with the director, Ben Zeitlin, last year. He and Beasts of the Southern Wild are up for Best Director and Best Picture at the Oscars this weekend, and 9-year-old Quvenzhané Janae Wallace is nominated for Best Actress. On Sunday night, you can see if they win and play Awards Night Bingo online along with us. Watch the ceremony and look for bingo tiles like Tells Kid to Go to Bed or Starts Crying. Get your bingo card at studio360.org. Susan Evans grew up in rural Louisiana during the 1950s and 60s, certainly not the racially integrated utopia depicted in Beasts of the Southern Wild. Her first year of high school was the first year of federally enforced integration in her town, and that did not sit well with her parents. Heads up, Susan's father used the racial slur common at that time, and it does figure in our story.
And I can remember my father would walk into my bedroom and see that my television was turned on to the Jeffersons. And he would say, "I don't want you watching those niggers on TV." And he would turn my TV off. So it was just a great deal of anger and difficulty with my family at that time.
Susan says she was never comfortable with that casual racism, but didn't have the courage to speak up. Years later, as an adult, she was watching TV one night and came across an old movie from 1947, Elia Kazan's Gentleman's Agreement.
I was watching Turner Classic Movies, and there it was. It really addresses all sorts of prejudice, but the central theme in this particular movie is anti-Semitism. Gregory Peck plays Philip Green, who is a famous or a very highly respected writer. So he goes undercover and actually pretends to be Jewish so that he can experience firsthand the anti-Semitism. Well, the romantic subplot that's going on is that he meets Dorothy McGuire, and it's just a wonderful match, and you love them. But she is very WASP, and she's from Connecticut and Darien, and there are some very closed societies up there and lots of restricted country clubs.
It's detestable, but that's the way it is. It's even worse in New Canaan. There, nobody can sell or rent to a Jew. And even in Darien, where Jane's house is and my house is, there's sort of a gentleman's agreement when you...
Gentlemen's? Kathy, you can't... You're not going to fight it, Kathy. You're just going to give in, play along, let their idiotic rules stand.
I don't play along. But what can one person do?
You can tell them to go jump in the lake.
And I think it was really... just a subject that was always on my mind at the time. So when I watched Gentleman's Agreement, I realized that answers a problem for me, and it's definitely not going to be easy, but I have got to have a conversation with my family. And every time I would go home, there would be a dinner or people sitting around visiting just the family. And they would immediately start in with the jokes about the blacks and the gays and women. And many, many times I would just get up, I would quietly just leave the room. It was protecting me from them, but it wasn't changing anything.
Oh, I hate it, I hate it, I hate everything about this horrible thing. They always make trouble for everybody, even their friends. They force people to take sides against them.
Quit that. They didn't suggest this series. They didn't give me the angle. They haven't got a single thing to do with what's happened between you and me.
Shout at me. And don't treat me to any more lessons of tolerance. I'm sick of it.
So Kathy, after the really bad fight, calls Dave Goleman, and he was in the army with Gregory Peck's character.
Do you think I'm anti-Semitic?
So they have this meeting in a restaurant.
No, Kathy, I don't.
Phil does.
Does he?
You know I'm not anti-Semitic. You're a Jew and you know it. Why can I make it clear to everybody but Phil?
And she is just kind of trying to pour her heart out and express her confusion, how she can't understand. She's on the same side as him. She doesn't understand what he wants.
Well, it was just a vulgar little joke that a man told at dinner. It has nothing to do with this.
Take it easy, Kathy. Maybe it has.
Oh, all right. It was a man named Lockhart, and he tried to get laughs with words like kike and coon and... I despised him and everybody else.
What did you do, Kathy, when he told the joke?
What do you mean?
I mean, what did you say when he finished?
I wanted to yell at him. I wanted to get up and leave. I wanted to say to everyone at that table, why do we sit here and take it when he's attacking everything that we believe in? Why don't we call him on it?
And what did you do?
I just sat there. I felt ashamed. We all just sat there.
Oh, I just love that.
Yeah.
That is definitely the scene that woke me up. When she suddenly realized what she had to do, that was the same moment that I realized what I had to do. All I did was at dinner one day, I looked down at my plate and I said, I don't think that's funny. And then instead of just walking away, I went on to say, I'm just not going to laugh at these kind of jokes anymore. I work with gay people. I work with blacks. These are my friends. They're wonderful human beings, and I'm just not going to participate in this anymore. The dinner just completely stopped when I said those words, quiet enough that you could have heard a pin drop. And I just had the feeling that suddenly I had the floor And it was such a quiet little moment. It passed. We finished our dinner. It was what happened later that was really significant to me, and that was privately, one by one, my siblings would come to me and tell me that they really didn't harbor those deep prejudices. They did begin to respect me more, and I noticed a drastic decrease in that kind of discussion when we would get together after that. You know, it is a pretty nervy thing to do, but I just knew after watching that movie, I knew I didn't have any choice. It was an epiphany. Finding the answer was right there all along in this film that was released in 1947.
You know something, Phil? I suddenly want to live to be very old. Very. I want to be around to see what happens.
A good film can change the world. This is what the movie did for me. And I'm grateful.
Wouldn't it be wonderful, Phil, if it turned out to be everybody's century? When people all over the world, free people, found a way to live together. I'd like to be around to see some of that, even the beginning.
Susan Evans is a painter in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she listens to the show on KANW. Is there some movie or book or other work of art or entertainment that taught you about life? We'd like to hear your story. Tell us at studio360.org. And that's it for this hour. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Posey Gruner,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Ruth Samuelson.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at KB Anderson, that's Anderson with an E, and at Studio 360 Show. You can also find the show and me on Facebook.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You probably remember her as the zany sister on the sitcom Roseanne, but Laurie Metcalf is a serious actress who is not afraid to go very dark.
Why do I see something young and beautiful and just want to scratch it and scratch it until none of it is left?
Laurie Metcalf stars in the fantastic new play The Other Place. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.